Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Many thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 70 conversations. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a hefty 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, and there'll be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll have my sincere gratitude, and most importantly, you'll be helping us develop the podcast. So to become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or by doing a quick Google search, or by looking at any of the other podcast pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get on with our latest episode, in which we speak to Halil Karaveli. He's a senior fellow at the Central Asia Caucasus Institute and Silk Road Studies Programme, and the author of the new book, Why Turkey is Authoritarian, From Atatürk to Erdogan, which is published by Pluto Press. The book is a bold, sweeping, and forcefully argued account that lays waste to a number of common misconceptions. In contrast to popular ideas that the division between secularism and Islam is the fundamental driver of Turkey's modern history since 1923, Karaveli takes an uncompromisingly class-based perspective. It is, he argues, the urge to protect dominant bourgeois class interests that lies behind authoritarianism in its civilian and military guises in contemporary Turkey. To start out, I asked Halil Karaveli to talk about what prompted him to write the book in the first place.
Basically, this book was written out of a sense of frustration that Turkey is constantly misunderstood. Turkish history is misunderstood and Turkish history is misrepresented in basically all, more or less all, standard history accounts and also in the media, international media coverage of Turkey. This media narrative that predominates, according to which Turkey is a place where Islam clashes with Western ideas, where secularism clashes with Islamization, a place where the military stages coups supposedly to protect secularism. This notion, which is totally misguided and misrepresents Turkish history, frustrated me. And I felt that someone had to set the record straight and reinterpret or correctly interpret Turkish history, the last 100 years of Turkish history. Of course, this doesn't mean that there are no other books that give a good picture of Turkish history. There are several, especially works done by Turkish Marxist historians and intellectuals. But these are kind of, they have led a marginal existence, and they don't have the, at least outside Turkey and also, of course, inside Turkey, the intellectual impact. So the narrative that dominates in academic accounts of Turkey and obviously in journalistic accounts are totally within this paradigm that I described, according to which Turkey is this place where Islam and secularism collide.
There is this very common assumption that really the force or conflict motor in modern Turkish history is this fundamental divide between secularism and religion, or between the centre and periphery, ever since the founding of the Republic of Turkey, really, back in 1923. But your book basically demolishes this pretty simplistic thesis. And what you argue instead is that the defining feature of modern Turkey is the underlying force of capitalism, reinforced by authoritarian right-wing rule that has dominated for decades. And that authoritarian rule has had different kind of secular or conservative flavours, but it's always had the same mission, really, of protecting the dominant economic interests from democratic challenges. And, you know, despite various other social or political conflicts on the surface, it's this class interest that has motivated the state elite over decades, really, and it lies behind all the kind of key developments in modern Turkish history.
Exactly. You put it very well, summarized it very well. And when the Turkish Republic was founded, it was a kind of explicitly bourgeois project. The cadres, the state cadres that set out to found a new state, had ambition to create what they called a national bourgeoisie. They set out to create a capitalist state. And this class aspect is totally ignored. But if you look at it from the on the surface, it looks like as if secularists and Islamists are clashing and the military are stepping in to protect the secular republic. But in fact, both secularism and Islam or Islamization are two sides of the same coin, two sides of the same right-wing coin, in the sense that both the military and the supposedly secularist state establishment and secularist politicians and the Islamist politicians and Islamist parties have both actually served the same bourgeois class interests. When the Turkish Republic was founded in the 1920s and 1930s, a certain form of bourgeois radicalism prevailed, because that was basically what answered to the needs of capitalist development at that stage. But as history evolved, and especially with the onset of the Cold War, it became instrumental to kind of shift from a bourgeois radicalism to a more bourgeois conservatism, as I describe it, with leading Turkish parties and the Turkish state resorting to conservatism in order to counter, as they saw it, the rising threat of the left during the Cold War. So what looks as a clash between secularists and Islamists, it is actually an intra-class conflict, and seen from a broader perspective, both the secular reforms and the Islamization followed starting basically from the late 1940s and it's continued throughout, has served the interests of the dominant economic interests in Turkey, dominant class interests. If you look at the military coups, 1960, 1971, 1980, and 1997, all these coups can actually be explained in terms of a class analysis. I don't say that is the only thing that explains these coups, but it's absolutely the most important factor behind these coups. The military has not stepped in, has not staged coups to protect secularism. It has basically stepped in to protect dominant economic class interests, and it has also had to step in situations where the internal dynamics of Turkish capitalism has kind of called for a military takeover. But the problem when you look at Turkey is that most observers tend to get focused on the cultural aspects, and they see, you know, secular people and Islamists, and if you look at it in a cultural perspective, it looks as if there is a clash, and there is indeed a clash also between them in a sense. But at the end of the day, and ultimately, it is actually two sides of the same coin. And just to give a very simple example, the last 15 years now that the Justice and Development Party has been in power, and that party has been, you know, portrayed as an Islamist party, and supposedly a party that represented the people against the state elite and the old elite. This is the way that has been portrayed. But after these 50 years of AKP's reign, we can observe that those that already were rich have become richer. The wealthy few have become wealthier, has prospered more during the AKP years, and the income inequalities have actually widened. The so-called secularist elite in Turkey, the bourgeoisie, has actually prospered during the 15 years of AKP, because AKP has served, just as all other conservative parties during Turkish history, the dominant economic interests.
One of the things the book does is it takes the story of capitalism in Turkey back to the origins, really, in the 19th century when really the Christian bourgeoisie planted its roots. And then in the early 20th century, in particular, there was an often violent changing of hands of capital, as Christians, you know, basically Greeks and Armenians, were forced out and their property was basically appropriated by the remaining Muslims in the new Republic of Turkey. And you write that, quote, "The Turkish case stands as a perfect illustration of Marx's words that capital is born covered in blood and filth." It's pretty uncompromising stuff. Just open this up for us a little bit.
Starting in the 19th century, early 19th century into the 20th century, what happened in the Ottoman Empire was that a Christian bourgeoisie got empowered. It consisted primarily of Greeks and Armenians and also Jews. And then due to their cultural affinity with Europe, their language skills, these Christian merchants and businessmen were in a privileged position. And Western European investors and businessmen privileged the Christian businessmen in the Ottoman Empire at the expense of the Muslim businessmen and Muslim traders and Muslim merchants. So you saw a class conflict here arising, which was also a cultural and religious conflict. That was the kind of thing that has been the theme in Turkey ever since, that cultural issues and class issues have been intertwined. So it was both a class conflict between a Christian bourgeoisie versus an intra-class conflict between the Christian bourgeoisie and the discriminated Muslim bourgeoisie in the Ottoman Empire. At the same time, it was also a conflict between what was basically a Muslim state elite and a Christian bourgeoisie. So what you saw here in the Ottoman Empire was a conflict between a kind of an authoritarian state, an authoritarian Muslim state elite, and a Christian bourgeoisie. So this is kind of, as we had in Europe, a conflict between an absolutist state and a rising bourgeoisie. The difference in the Ottoman Empire was that this was not only a conflict between the absolutist state and a rising bourgeoisie, but it was also a cultural conflict. It was because the rising bourgeoisie was Christian and the absolutist state power was predominantly represented by a Muslim bureaucracy. So the Ottoman impasse was that how do you kind of reconcile the empowerment of a Christian bourgeoisie and the imperative of maintaining kind of a Muslim, what was actually a Muslim theocracy. You know, in a normal sense, in what happened in Europe, it was that absolutist state power yielded eventually to the demands of the rising bourgeoisie. That was what happened with the French Revolution, etc. We saw all over Europe during the 18th century and 19th century. But that could not happen in the Ottoman Empire because yielding to the Christian bourgeoisie was kind of something that was unacceptable for absolutist state power in the Ottoman Empire, because that would have meant giving up sort of the Islamic identity of the state. And this was what led the nationalist Turkish, the Young Turks in the early 20th century, and afterwards their followers, the Kemalists, the revolutionaries, to endeavor to create the national bourgeoisie. And the First World War gave them the perfect opportunity. It actually started already. The Young Turk government, the last government of the Ottoman Empire, set out to kind of ethnically cleanse the Ottoman Empire of its Greek inhabitants. And of course, during the First World War, they executed the genocide of the Ottoman Armenians. They saw the Armenians as a threat to the security of the Ottoman Empire, to the Ottoman state, but there was also a very clear ambition to transfer the wealth and the properties of the Ottoman Armenians to the Muslims and to create this new Muslim bourgeoisie. And I quote in my book, Talat Pasha, the interior minister of the Ottoman Empire, the Young Turk interior minister, and the chief architect of the Armenian genocide, who sent out cables to the local governors, instructing them to kind of make sure that the properties, the farms, were transferred to what they called loyal Muslim citizens. The creation of a capitalist class in the modern Republic of Turkey was the result of this huge transfer of wealth. It is a highly sensitive issue, and although it has become more possible in Turkey during the last decade to talk about the Armenian genocide, this issue still, this transfer of wealth, is kept as a state secret, and the state records, the Turkish state records showing how this was executed, this transfer of wealth, are still not open to any kind of public scrutiny because it is an extremely sensitive issue. And I try to show with a few examples in the book how much this has meant. And I give, for instance, the example of Hacı Ömer Sabancı, who was the founder of one of the major capitalist dynasties in Turkey, the Sabancı Group, and how he started off as a poor boy with two empty hands, and how he prospered, how the foundations of his business empire was the result of he getting the state handing over Armenian property to him in the Çukurova region in southern Turkey. And there are also also other cases. This was the dowry, in a sense, of the new republic, the Armenian properties and the Greek properties of the Christian, the properties of the Christian bourgeoisie. Of course, the minority of the Ottoman Armenians were rich merchants, etc. But this was, you know, taken together, all this land, farms, holdings, bank savings and banks, was a huge amount of wealth.
One of the common assumptions is really that the military coups that have struck Turkey over the decades have all been variations of a kind of secularist institution protecting the state against Islamic traditions. And your book basically kind of torpedoes this very simplistic idea. And it's probably the 1980 coup that demonstrates this more than any others, really. This coup really is central to Turkey's contemporary history. It brings all kinds of things into sharp relief and arguably actually paves the way to the current political dominance of religion-inflected nationalism in Turkey. Kenan Evren, the leader of the coup, was the son of a mullah, and he kind of expanded religious education vastly, and the military promoted this Turkish Islamic synthesis, which basically was this kind of right-wing blend of Turkish nationalism and Islam as a kind of way to neutralize the leftist threat, which was very significant in the 1970s. Just talk about these common misconceptions about the Turkish military, and specifically how the 1980 military coup fits into your thesis.
As to describe it very well, it's actually amazing that although this is recognized by some scholars, few have kind of been willing to draw the conclusion, the right conclusions of the 1980 coup and see the military's role in this proper light. Now, not only the 1980 coup, but it's also the coup 1971 was a clear example of a right-wing coup. The Turkish military has not at all been unlike the militaries in Latin America, in Chile or Argentina, places like that, where the militaries have stepped in to crush the left and protect dominant economic interests. So it's quite amazing. I find it quite amazing, actually, that this myth of the Turkish military as a secular watchdog has survived for so long. Because when you look at it, the 1980 coup and the 1971, especially those two coups, are very clear what the military set out to do. And of course, yes, 1980 was a turning point. It was a turning point in the sense that the Turkish left, the crushing the left, which was kind of the mission of the military, in that the military succeeded so well that the Turkish left has never been able to recover after 1980. There's a very clear line that connects Evren and Recep Tayyip Erdogan, both in the sense that what they did, cultural terms, this more pronounced Islamization, and also their authoritarian traits. So, yes, it is actually something of an enigma why so few have been willing to recognize the class character and the ideological character of what the military has been doing. And that, I think, is basically because the established narrative is to view things in culture terms, the cultural and the religious, always overshadow, in the case of Turkey, ideological and class aspects. And of course, what complicates matters is the fact that when the military, after 1980, again staged a coup, the so-called postmodern coup, 1997, against the first Islamist prime minister of Turkey, Necmettin Erbakan, forced him basically to resign. That intervention fitted so well into this narrative of Islam versus secularism, because the military overthrew an Islamist prime minister who was actually heading a coalition government with a conservative party, a secular conservative party. So it really did kind of reinforce this perception, the 1997 postmodern coup, that the military was actually protecting secularist interests. But as I describe it, actually, the coups 1971 and 1980, they were clear-cut examples of the military stepping in a class conflict, where you have a conflict between the bourgeoisie and the working class. And the military steps in and protects the interests of the bourgeoisie. But what happened in 1997 was that the military stepped in what was an intra-class conflict. It intervened in what was a conflict between two factions of the Turkish bourgeoisie. One, a big bourgeoisie, the established big bourgeoisie, which has a Western outlook in cultural terms, and the new rising bourgeoisie coming from Anatolia, the so-called Anatolian Tigers. Now, so what you saw in 1997 and 1990s was increasingly that there was a conflict between the big business faction of the Turkish bourgeoisie and the rising bourgeoisie. And this got colored, as has been the case all throughout Turkish history, this intra-class conflict, like class conflict generally, was intertwined with culture and religion. Because while the established bourgeoisie has this kind of Western outlook, the women don't cover their heads, they drink alcohol, things like that, while the new rising bourgeoisie from Anatolia were represented by more conservative, more pious people. So this easily lended itself to a perception that this was a kind of conflict going on between Islamists or religious conservatives and secularists. And what the military did in 1997 was that it intervened in favor of the established big bourgeoisie, which kind of felt threatened by the rise of what was then described as green capital in Turkey, represented by the Anatolian religious conservative bourgeoisie. So in 1971 and 1980, we have a clear class conflict with the military protecting the bourgeoisie against the working class. In 1997, we have the military stepping in and protecting one faction of the bourgeoisie, the big business interests, against another faction, the religious conservative businessmen. This is actually something that has, of course, contributed in recent times to reinforcing the image of the Turkish military as a secularist watchdog, and also overshadowing what had happened before 1980 and 1971. One reason for this is, of course, that what happened in Turkey in the 1960s and 1970s, leading up to the 1980 coup, is the forgotten part of Turkish history. What I really try to do in my book is to excavate those decades, especially the 1970s, because I believe that that is the crucial turning point of Turkish history. It is also the part of Turkish history which is almost totally overlooked in standard histories of Turkey. And since those decades are entirely overlooked in standard histories, that is also the reason why Turkish history becomes unintelligible and lends itself to those fixation which has happened since the 1990s, the seeming conflict between Islamists and secularists, with a total focus on that, distorts retroactively the view of Turkish history. So the important, the crucial point is to understand what happened in the 1960s and 1970s, the class conflict that led to the 1980 coup, which in turn then explains what has followed since then.
So looking back at that 1960s, 1970s period, one of the key characters that you identify in the book is Bülent Ecevit. And he was head of the CHP in the 1970s and prime minister for some of that time. And he kind of stands out really as this figure who, you know, he's really probably the only electorally successful leftist leader in modern Turkish history. He kind of rejuvenated the social democratic left during the turbulent era of the 1970s. And I wonder if you could just talk here about Ecevit and why you see him as such a key figure to consider in this period that led up to the 1980 coup.
When you look at comparable countries to Turkey, Greece, Spain, Portugal, and what happened in those countries during the 1970s, you see that socialist parties, social democrats, and of course communist parties played a key role in the passages from authoritarian, right-wing authoritarian rule to democracies. In the case of Greece, in the case of Spain, and also in the case of Portugal. And this is also something that generally taken, I argue, that social democracy and the democratic left is crucial in the passage from authoritarianism to democracy. And this was also something that could have happened in Turkey during the 1970s, because just as was the case in Spain, Portugal, and Greece, social democracy and democratic left, the left in general, was on the rise in Turkey during the 1960s and 1970s. But unlike the cases of Spain, Portugal, and Greece, the left in Turkey was crushed. Social democracy was not allowed to gain and remain in power. And this explains why Turkey went wrong and did not follow the same path which it could have. So this is just a key to understanding what happened to Turkey, is to understand the 1970s, the rise of social democracy and the crushing of social democracy. Turkey, which could have been a new Greece or Spain or Portugal, instead turned into another Chile, that where the left was crushed in the coup in 1973, a military dictatorship was established. And the key figure in this context is Bülent Ecevit. And he is not only one of the few leftist leaders who have been successful in Turkish history, he is the only leftist leader who has been successful. Ecevit is to date the only leftist who has been the prime minister of Turkey. And in the case of Bülent Ecevit, it's a tragic case. And he's one of the, you could say, he's the kind of main character, the main kind of hero of the book. Now, the reason why Ecevit stands apart is not only because the only leftist that has ruled Turkey, he also stands out because he broke the traditions, the political behavior that has characterized the Turkish left before him and which has characterized him after him as well. And the reason why the left has been unsuccessful in Turkey is not only because of the severe oppression that the state, the severe oppression of which it has been the victim throughout modern Turkish history. I start my book by describing how Atatürk killed off the whole leadership of the Turkish Communist Party in 1921. That kind of initial act of violence, that is a kind of defining act of political crime that set the tone for what has followed since then. Now, the Turkish left has not only been oppressed, it has also been crippled by its own inability to reach out to the popular masses. Since 1950, the Turkish conservative parties, have won every single election, save for two, in 1973 and 1977. Those two elections were won by the CHP, which was defined as a democratic leftist party, led by Bülent Ecevit. And in 1977, which was the glorious moment of Turkish social democracy, Ecevit won with 42% of the votes. And he did so because he succeeded in reaching out to the popular masses. Unlike those other so-called progressives in Turkey, he did not treat pious people as reactionaries. Ecevit said that the historical mistake of the Turkish left has been to equate religion with reaction and treat impious people as reactionaries. Ecevit said that even if you go to the mosque, even if you are pious, you can be a leftist, you can be a progressive. He did not see a contradiction between being pious and being progressive. And that enabled him to reach out to the masses. Instead of fighting religion, instead of fighting traditions, the traditions of the people, the cultural and religious traditions, he took issue with capitalism. He did not take issue with religion. He took issue with capitalism. He took issue with social injustices, with economic inequalities. And that made him a successful leader in 1977. It's so striking that Ecevit and his democratic left, the CHP, carried all of the conservative strongholds of Turkey. For instance, Konya, which has kind of been since the bastion of religious conservatism, CHP won with 42% of the votes. It really illustrates that he, during Ecevit's leadership, this secular religious artificial divide was transcended by appealing to the people by bringing the question of social justice and economic equality to the fore. That is what makes Ecevit such an interesting figure, because he shows that a left that transcends religious and cultural divides can succeed in Turkey. And of course, it is so tragic that Ecevit was not allowed to succeed, because he was caught in the crossfire of all those interests that he challenged, the Turkish bourgeoisie, the fascist militias, the military, and also the United States, that saw the specter of Turkey led by a social democratic leader as unacceptable in a geopolitical perspective. So Ecevit was caught in the crossfire of all those interests that he challenged, and he was tragically crushed, as was the whole Turkish left. And what we saw in Turkey during the 1970s was a terrible bloodbath, where fascist death squads killed thousands of leftist students, university teachers, intellectuals, trade union activists. And they had the support. They were entrenched within the state, the fascist militias. And actually, what happened at the end, the military in 1980 kind of finished off the job that the fascist death squad had commenced during the early 1970s. So I think that in the case of Ecevit, what I really try to do is excavate the memory of Ecevit, to excavate the memory of the 1960s and 1970s, to show how crucial and decisive the class conflict, the class aspect has been in Turkey, because those decades really illustrate that. And also because even if the outcome was tragic, the end was tragic, still the social example of Ecevit and the rise of the democratic left in the 1970s is also something that shows that Turkey is not fated to remain authoritarian. It's not fated to remain stuck in this secularist Islam division, that artificial division can be transcended if progressives privilege social issues, if they take issue with capitalism instead of taking issue with Islam. And this we saw recently, a little sign of this during the recent election in Turkey when the social democratic candidate Muharrem Ince, in a sense, copied what Ecevit had been doing during the 1970s by demonstrating that he had no problems with people's religious beliefs or how they dress and things like that.
Now, one of the very striking arguments that you make throughout the book, you referred to it there actually, is that the right in Turkey has generally kind of monopolized the working class vote by kind of playing on religion and nationalist sentiment. You know, populist conservatives on the campaign trail have for decades spoken to people's religious feelings and inchoate resentment of the elite. But then while in power, they've kind of served the interests of that elite. And it's been a very winning formula, really, for the right for decades. And of course, this is something not actually unique to Turkey, really. Across Europe, something similar can be detected. And particularly, of course, in the US, there's a very similar dynamic going on. You know, the Republican Party playing on cultural conservatism while serving the interests of business. I wonder if you could talk about these kind of parallels, really, between Turkey and other examples.
Absolutely. I think that I really believe that Turkey is not only an interesting country in itself. The Turkish example has also a broader significance and broader relevance. And I see Turkey as a warning example, as I write in the book, a warning example of what happens when the left neglects social issues and focuses on cultural issues, like the left in Turkey have been doing, focusing on the question of promoting secularism instead of promoting the issue of social justice, and handing over the moral high ground to the conservatives, who have been able to appeal to the popular masses' religious feelings and the cultural resentment of the urban elite, and then in power, of course, serving the interests of the business elite. And this is, you know, in that sense, what the likes of Donald Trump and the Republicans in the United States are doing now. You know, they did not invent this tactic. This has been successfully been executed, this tactic, by the Turkish right since the late 1940s. So in that sense, the Turkey is really a warning example of what happens when the left sees the moral high ground to the right by treating the popular masses as belonging in a basket of deplorables, as Hillary Clinton said during the campaign about the people who voted for Donald Trump. And this has basically been the attitude of those who call themselves leftists and call themselves progressives in Turkey. They have treated, you know, the popular masses as if they belonged in a basket of deplorables because they were allegedly reactionaries and they were backward and they needed to be enlightened. And Ecevit wrote already in the 1950s a very interesting article that I quote, where he severely criticized and said that the reason why Turkey remains authoritarian is not because the people are supposedly backward, it is because those who call themselves enlightened or call themselves progressives treat the people as reactionaries and backward, and by doing that serve the cause of the right, who can appeal to the popular masses, win their votes, and then execute these unjust economic and social policies. So in that sense, yes, Turkey there is much to learn from the Turkish examples. There is much that progressives, those who call themselves progressives in the United States and Europe, can learn from looking at how self-professed progressives have behaved in Turkey and what that has led to. Because this is really the case, because Turkey has remained authoritarian because a populist right has monopolized the working class vote and the left has crippled itself by waging this culture war in the name of secularism or in the name of enlightenment, which has cut it off from the popular masses, alienated them, except in the case of Bülent Ecevit. So I think that there's much to learn from the Turkish example, and I think that Ecevit can be an inspiring example, not only in the Turkish context, but also generally for progressives internationally, in the way he reached out to the masses by speaking their language and going out to the neighborhoods and connecting with the working class instead of turning his back to the people. Like, I think that is very, very important that the progressives worldwide learn from the warning examples of the self-professed progressives in Turkey.
The irony, of course, with Edge of it is that he was actually a member, really, of the kind of aristocracy in a way. And he himself was a kind of intellectual type of character. You know, he was a translator of Sanskrit and he wrote poetry. And he was really a very thinking man in many ways. And he came from a very well-off background. And it was funny that he sort of became the kind of tribune of a kind of working class politics in the 1970s that, you know, it shows you that nothing really is kind of foreordained, I suppose.
No, by contrast, some of the leading right-wing politicians in Turkey, they have Erdogan is one example, there are other examples, or have very, very, very simple background, peasant boys, and they have risen to become the part of the ruling class. But they have also, because of their backgrounds, Erdogan, and before even Süleyman Demirel, let me name one, have been very successful in speaking the language of the popular masses. They had had this credibility when they have said that, "We are on the side of you, the people. We do not reject you. We do not treat you as deplorable." And that says they have. That is also something that explains the success of a leader like Erdogan. Although he served the interests of, like all other his conservative predecessors, although he served the interests of the business elite, he has his credibility at the popular tribune. Now, Edirne is a very interesting example. I sketch his portrait in this book. I also believe that he deserves a full-scale biography, actually. And he's also fascinating on this personal level, because his roots went back to the Ottoman palace, his family tradition. And he also came from a family of religious scholars, and he was a poet and intellectual. And no one during the early 50s would have figured that this kind of intellectual who didn't like socializing, who preferred the company of books, would turn into this tribune. So it's really a fascinating example. But I think also that parts of his background kind of explain why he was able to reach out to the masses. Because of his family background and his feeling for religion, he was a pious person himself. He did not have this hang-up. He did not have this antipathy toward Islam, which is characterized many self-professed progressive intellectuals in Turkey. And actually, Ecevit, although being one of the kind of foremost intellectuals in Turkey during the 20th century, he never liked the intellectuals. He kept apart from them. He said once that he felt at home with the popular masses, with the workers and the normal, ordinary peasants, and not with the intellectuals, with the intellectual circles from which he originated. So you could say that the right-wing leaders in Turkey, they have generally made kind of the journey from the popular masses into the business elite and in power serve the interests of the business elite. Ecevit is a totally contrarian example. He made a reverse journey. He came from the Ottoman aristocracy and the new state elite of the Turkish state, and he made the journey toward the popular masses, to the workers and the peasants. And in that sense, yeah, he is a very fascinating figure, and I hope that my book will contribute to renewed interest for Ecevit and what he meant in the context of the Turkish history.
One of the things that I wondered as I was reading the book, I wondered if you didn't downplay really the kind of threat that hung like a kind of sword of Damocles really throughout the much of the 20th century, which was the kind of Soviet threat. You know, a small mm-hmm. example would be after the Second World War, when there were clear territorial designs on eastern Turkey. Stalin had clear designs on the eastern provinces of Turkey, and there was this very serious and constantly foregrounded threat that was there in the Turkish elite's minds. And it waxed and waned over the decades, but it was always there. Obviously, it was pumped up quite dramatically by the right as well, and they exploited that danger. But it's also important, I think, to look at Turkish history and understand the kind of dynamics that were going on by kind of seeing how there was this constant Soviet threat that did, in a way, kind of circumscribe a lot of the left. I wonder if you could just kind of respond to that criticism as well.
You could always argue that, of course, being a frontline state in the Cold War, of course, is a major reason why Turkey was not allowed to take to follow the same path as for instance, Spain and Portugal. It's just a country that bordered the Soviet Union, and in a geopolitical sense, it carried an extreme importance in the designs of the United States in the dynamic of the Cold War. But when it comes to the Soviet threat, yeah, you mentioned the threat that we formulated, the demand that Stalin made after the Second World War, But I believe that those statements have been blown out of proportion, and should also remember that the context was that during the Second World War, Turkey had been a so-called neutral country, but it had been very much aligned with Nazi Germany. It was only at the very latest stages of the Second World War that the Turkish regime, seeing that the Allies were going to win, shifted and tried to orient itself toward the Western alliance. So what Stalin said there, we need to see that in the context coming out of this, seeing Turkey as a state that had sided very much with the Nazi Germany during much of the Second World War. So there was a kind of animosity, understandable animosity, I would say, on the part of the Soviet Union, which had, of course, been the major victim of the Nazi onslaught. That they saw Turkey in less than friendly terms. Again, so of course, you could, if you see the Soviet Union in the terms of that the right-wingers in American and other right-wingers have seen, then of course you see Soviet Union as this expansionist power and try to grab and take over the so-called free world. But I do not subscribe to that notion, actually. You know, both the United States and the Soviet Union were guilty of atrocities or acts of violence during the Cold War. And I just see that what happened, the violence that happened, took place in Turkey during the Cold War, and the coups and the killings, etc. None of these emanated from the Soviet Union. They were either supported by the actively or passively by the United States, the coups, and all that violence, the killings during the 1960s and 1970s, and killings of leftist intellectuals starting already in the 1940s, when for instance, the socialist writer Sabahattin Ali was, you know, killed, his head smashed. White Turkish security agent as he was trying to flee to Bulgaria. The case of Nazım Hikmet, a world-famous poet who was in prison for decades and then had to flee to the Soviet Union for his life. And several other leading Turkish intellectuals, left-wing intellectuals, were persecuted or imprisoned and even killed. And I cannot in any way subscribe and say that these acts, despicable acts, were in any way excusable or even understandable because of the presence of a Soviet threat. That is not anything that I can subscribe to. But you could say that the specter of communism in general, of course, was something that terrified the Turkish bourgeoisie and the state that served the interests of the bourgeoisie. Yes, in that sense, yes. But it is more American interventions. It was only the American interventions that is kind of responsible for maintaining and sustaining authoritarianism, oppression in Turkey. And I don't think any of that can be excused by reference to any, as I believe, largely imaginary Soviet threat. But if you do subscribe to the notion that the Soviet Union was an expansionist power and was trying to swallow up the free so-called free world during the Cold War, and that because of that you excuse right-wing violence and oppression, authoritarianism, then you end up in an untenable situation, because that leads you to supporting Somoza in Nicaragua, you support Salazar in Portugal and Franco in Spain. All these things were, you know, by the right in the Western world, excused with reference to this supposed threat of world communism. I believe that's an untenable ideological position.
That was Halil Karabeli. Many thanks to him. Please do remember to consider supporting Turkey Book Talk by joining as a member. All you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Patreon. Membership gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. You also get exclusive access to a 30% discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk pages, and many thanks to all current members, it's very much appreciated. Also, just a bit of housekeeping here in case you missed it in the last episode. If you're following every Thursday for my book reviews in the Hürriyet Daily News, I recently left HDN, so no more reviews from me in there, I'm afraid. The archive is still online though, so if you fancy it, you can still leaf through over 5 years of reviews. Find a link to the archive at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or again, of course, you can just do a Google search. Do rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you use. You can also follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.